Good morning and welcome to the class. Today we're going to pick up in the 20th chapter of Acts in verse 7. We've had several occasions in this study to learn how to establish authority for those things that we believe and practice. And in this study today, we have another opportunity to examine a passage from the standpoint of determining a sufficient authority is present for something that we consider important in our service unto God, or is it there's insufficient grounds to establish the authority that we have for this practice. Of course, the practice you know I'm talking about is the observance of the Lord's Supper, and it's held in high esteem by Christians. Yet many claiming to be Christians don't look at this supper in that same regard. There are questions that have arisen among the brotherhood about the supper, and one has become an issue even among conservative brethren here in the Houston area. So while this lesson will not be a study of the Lord's Supper itself, it will study the supper from the standpoint that is brought out in the 7th verse and the context in our study today. In this verse 7, where we're going to begin our study today, it's a verse that means a lot to us as followers of Christ. Yet in this verse, there's no command given. But yet we still look to this verse as an important authority for an important part of our worship, and that is the partaking of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. And the question is, are we correct to do that? I believe we are. And so that's, you know, what I want to talk about here for the next while. And the things that we can learn about our worship as we learn from this study and the surrounding verses. Let me begin by let's review verses 7 through 11. On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul talked with them, intending to depart on the next day, and he prolonged his speech until midnight. There were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered. And a young man named Eutychus, sitting at the window, sank into a deep sleep as Paul talked still longer. And being overcome by sleep, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. But Paul went down and bent over him, and taking him in his arms, said, "Now do not be alarmed, for his life is in him." And when Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten, he conversed with them a long time until daybreak, and so departed. As we look in verse 7, there's three expressions used at the beginning of this verse that I want to take a look at. The first expression is on the first day of the week. The second is we were gathered together. And the third is to break bread. So looking at this expression on the first day of the week, I ask you the question, why did Luke signify this day of the event in this passage? You may or may not have noticed, but in our study of Acts, Luke has not identified days of the week. For instance, when was Paul and Silas in jail in Philippi? We don't know. Throughout the events that we've been studying, a day of the week has not been identified. When you look at the first part of the book of Acts, chapters 1 through 12, you have only the allusion to the first day of the week in an indirect way, and that is in Acts 2 and 1 when Luke records on the day of Pentecost, talking about the disciples being gathered and the Holy Spirit came upon them. But that's not a specific reference to the first day of the week, but is to the day of Pentecost. It's by definition of the day of Pentecost that it falls on the first day of the week. Because when you go down into the Old Testament and it's 50 days after the Passover ended, that would automatically fall on the first day of the week using the Jewish calendar. So there it was the first day of the week. But it doesn't specify it as that. The only other day that he refers to is the Sabbath. Because in Paul's travels, that was the day when the Jews would be in the synagogues, and it was his custom to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath to speak to the Jews. So again, the Sabbath is the only day that's specifically mentioned on multiple occasions because it was a day of Jewish worship. So I suggest to you that it's important that we look now. Here Luke, for the first time, really pinpoints a day of the week. And all that we've studied, he finally addresses a particular day. On the first day of the week is the way this passage begins. Let me ask you this. How many times is this expression, the first day of the week, used in the New Testament? And let's say outside of the Gospels. In the Gospels, it's used to refer to the events surrounding the resurrection of Jesus. For instance, when the women went to the grave site on the first day of the week. Expressions associated with that is its use in the Gospels. So getting outside of the Gospels, how many times is this expression used?
Twice.
It's used here, and it's used in 1 Corinthians 16. When he's talking about the collection for the saints on the first day, he says to take up a collection. Those are the only two times this expression is used in the New Testament. So it's a significant expression for it to be used here. And it's an expression that we shouldn't take lightly. It's an expression that I would say that is there very intentionally by the Holy Spirit as he guided Luke in his writing. So perhaps, as I use the term word picture, perhaps we see here Luke forming a word picture as he starts this passage on the first day of the week. Now, what else, you know, we can consider in this, was this day arbitrary for what follows? I would suggest that it's not arbitrary for one of what we've already said, the uniqueness of this expression and the reference to a particular day in Luke's writing and really in the New Testament itself. But does this signify a regular event for the first day of the week? Or does this was it only for this week that Paul was there? Was it just this occasion that this is mentioned? And in writing this on the first day of the week, did it mean every week? So those are some things that I want us to look at. Was this simply a convenience for those in Troas? Whereas in another city, it might have been another day of the week. So again, what I want to look at. So many people in today's world are guided by an expression that's found in the 1 Corinthians letter, chapter 11, as off as you do. And so the first day of the week is insignificant in their thinking, just as off as you do. As a teenager, I had a discussion with a man who was a Methodist. And the discussion was on the Lord's Supper. And he disregarded this verse. And the reason he disregarded it was because of the expression that we just referred to in 1 Corinthians 11. As often as you do. It doesn't matter when you do it. It doesn't matter how often as you do it. But whenever you do it, it should be done, you know, properly as directed in 1 Corinthians 11. So that's the thinking of a lot of people. And this verse is not recognized as in any sense authoritative. Looking at the second expression, when we were gathered together, and whatever was done on this first day of the week, we notice here in this expression, it was done in the assembly. It was done when they gathered together. It was not done privately. It was not in the privacy of a home or the family. It was not an individual matter. I understand that partaking is an individual matter, because one has to examine his own heart and one has to individually partake worthily, as it talks about in 1 Corinthians 11. But that's not the point. The point is that it's an activity that is done within the confines of the assembly. As we read the verse, on the first day of the week when we were gathered together. So this idea to me is conclusive and it's decisive, that this is an activity of the brethren in Troas when they assembled together here on this first day of the week, in which Paul and Luke and others that were with him joined in on this. Paul, we notice, remained in Troas. It says in verse 6, where we stayed for 7 days. we know that Paul was in a rush, because in verse 16 of this same chapter, after he had left Troas, it says he decided to sail past Ephesus so that he might not have to spend some time in Asia, for he was hastening to be at Jerusalem if possible on the day of Pentecost. So Paul was in effect in a hurry during this time of these 7 days that he chose to stay. We know he'd liked to have been at Ephesus. He'd already spent a couple of years there on this journey. And so a lot had built up. A lot of good things had built up between him and the church. And we know that when he met with the elders of Ephesus later in this chapter, you can tell from that letter how much Paul would like to have been there with them. But yet he chose to spend these 7 days there in Troas. It could have been because of what was discussed last week. Remember, he had had an open door of opportunity in Troas. But because he had not received word of how the brethren in Corinth had received his letter, he left that door of opportunity and went on over to Macedonia to meet Silas and learn of the brethren in Corinth's acceptance of his letter. So it may have been for that reason that he spent those 7 days here. But nonetheless, whatever the reason, he stayed here and had the opportunity to meet with them on this Lord's Day. And so they would have been there to partake of this. And so we come to the third of these expressions, and that is, on the first day of the week, when we gather together, to break bread. Now, the first thing that I think about when I think about this passage, this particular part of it, in the light of the study that I have, is what is this statement trying to say? Is this a statement of time, or is it a statement of purpose? Now, the passage itself says when we would gather together to break bread. This suggestion that is suggests to me that we have to consider time. That this was identifies the time when they gathered together to break bread. The passage clearly states they came together on the first day of the week to break bread. Now, let me ask you a question. Why do we gather together? Why do we assemble here today? Why? Why are you here? Let me suggest Psalms 122. Beginning in verse 1, the psalmist says, I was glad when they said to me, let us go into the house of the Lord. Why was he glad? Go down to verse 4, he says, to give thanks. The idea is, we're here to worship God. That's the primary reason we're here, is to worship God. Okay? Now, consider passages, and this would not be the only passage. Consider passages such as Colossians 3, 16 and 17, where it talks about our singing, a parallel passage to Ephesians 5, 19. But after it talks about singing, whatever you do, it says, give thanks. Again, the idea is worship unto God. In 1 Corinthians 11, in talking about the subject before us, the Lord's Supper, what does he say? He says, to proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. That's worship. See, I suggest to you that the reason we're here primarily is to worship God. That's the reason we've come. Right. Yeah.
Just a note, several brethren have said it's edification. We are here to worship God, but I can worship God at home. I can worship singing at home. I can worship God praying at home. But I can't edify my brethren doing that.
Okay.
So while we're gathered together to worship, there's another element involved. By worshiping together, as God planned in the local church, edification is accomplished, which is not accomplished if we do it alone.
I agree. I don't argue that.
I just enlarged on those comments that you made. I think those brethren were right on target.
Well, I agree. But again, the point that I'm trying to make is we're here to worship God. Edification is a part is comes out of that, but we're here to worship God, and so we engage in these activities with a pure heart and with a thankful heart. But I would suggest to you that none of these things that we come here today and participate in are a sole reason that we're here. There are things that we engage in. Somebody used the word commandment. Yes, they're commandment. That edification has been brought out. We're edified through these things. But all of these within themselves are not the sole purpose, the absolute purpose of this assembly. As Steve just brought out, we can sing at home. James 5 talks about singing and praying at home. Certainly these things can be done at home. In Acts 18, we saw that where Aquila and Priscilla took aside Apollos and explained the Word of God to him. So again, here was study. That was in the context of one's home. And all of these things are done with thankfulness and the right attitude. And all of these things have to do with our private worship unto God. But here in this public assembly coming together, we come together and worship God. Now, so I would suggest to you that within the confines of the assembly, when we come together, we don't have as an absolute purpose that partaking of the Lord's Supper. Now, some people do, because I've known in the past, and I'm sure you've known in the past, that there's some people who would conduct themselves as that's why they're here. They arrive right before it's time to partake, and they'll leave as soon as it's over. That is why they came. And I will admit, I've been guilty of myself of making the statement that, well, you know, the purpose of the Lord's of the Sunday assembly is to partake of the Lord's Supper because that's the only day it's authorized. Well, I don't know that would be correct to say it's the purpose of it, as I used to say, but it's certainly something that we do when we come. But as I said, some people conduct themselves as it is their purpose because they'll come and they'll leave based upon when the supper is. I would suggest to you that, with some exception, that perhaps if that's the attitude of a person, maybe they didn't come to worship. Maybe they came just to partake of the supper. But they didn't come to worship. They didn't come to edify. They didn't come to be edified. And I'd suggest to you that perhaps they would be found guilty of the body and blood of Christ, of partaking unworthily. And the very point that the reason they came to take would not be satisfied in their relationship with God. Same for preaching. We've all known people that as soon as the preaching is over, they're gone. What happens after that, if someone should respond to the gospel, is not important for them to stick around and find out. The song and the encouragement through the song and the worship through the song is not important enough. And the closing prayer, whatever it may say, is not important enough. I've seen this particularly when people travel. And maybe when they're out of town for some sporting event. And that event's, you know, maybe an hour after assembly ends. So they get a head start by leaving. But I've seen this attitude, you know, that, you know, we can curtail, you know, this worship. And I would suggest that we're overlooking why we really can't. Now, I want us to look at our authority for our weekly observance on the first day of the week. And ask the question, does God use examples? Does God use examples to establish authority for our actions? Or are examples just that? An example that has, you know, no intent to be binding or to be authoritative. Back in the mid-70s, I met with an eldership. We didn't meet on Sunday night at the church I went to, and there was a liberal church in the area. So on Sunday night, another man and I started going over there. We spoke to the elders at first and said that we just wanted to talk with people before and after service and you know, about some things that divided us and so forth. And they said, fine, go ahead, we don't care. Well, after a while, they did care. So they called us in one night and dressed us down pretty good. So we asked them if they were willing to sit down and study it. And so they said yes. So as it turned out for me, the other man that was with me wasn't able to make it. So I met with these elders. And I went through a whole smell of things that kept us and them from worshiping together. And I got through and they said, we agree. I was kind of taken back. And I said, well, then what's the issue? What's the difference? And the statement one of the elders made was, we don't look at examples as binding. We only look at direct statements as binding. So I thought about that for a minute, and I said, well, what about Acts 20 and verse 7? I said, we only have an example of the first day of the week to partake of the Lord's Supper. Why don't we do like denominationalists do? Why don't we partake of it every quarter, every 6 months? And one of the elders, the one elder that had responded previously, said to me, says, well, we could do that. And I said, well, what keeps you from doing that? And his answer was, well, it's not as spiritual. I said, well, if that's the case, would it be more spiritual to take of it every day? And he said, well, yeah, it would. We could do it every day. The other elder, I looked over at, Leroy, do you agree with that? And he said, no, I don't agree with that. Well, if I'd have been like Paul, as we're going to study later on, where he got the Pharisees and the Sadducees going at each other, that might have been the right thing for me to have done. I don't know, but I was a young buck. I wasn't experienced. And so I moved on past that. But that's the attitude, you see, that's very prevalent now among those that we would hope would understand how to establish authority. But yet you look, when only they look at direct statements and take out the examples that we have, then really the door becomes open quite a bit, you see, as to how they're going to conduct themselves in the affairs of the kingdom. So this is the same thought process that the Methodists had, you see. You've got the denominational people and people who claim to be Christians in the sense that we would understand a Christian, looking at examples the same way, that they don't really mean anything. They're just that. Now, we've already studied Acts 15, and in that study, we looked at ways of establishing authority. Now, so the question is this example here binding as to the first day of the week, every week, and within the confines of the local church assembled? Now, the scriptures talk about examples. In John chapter 13, in some of the final instructions Jesus gave to his apostles, he gave them an example that he expected them to follow. This was an example of humility and experience, but he expected them to follow that. And Acts chapter 15, that we've already talked about, both Peter and Barnabas and Paul gave examples of their work with the Gentiles as proof of God's acceptance of the Gentile without circumcision. In 1 Peter chapter 2, Jesus, through Peter's writings, Jesus' suffering is used as an example for us. And there's some examples that are negative. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul gives some examples from the Old Testament of the type of conduct we're to stay away from, not how we're not to conduct ourselves, and so that we might avoid the consequences of such conduct. In Philippians chapter 4, verse 5, Paul wrote that they were to do those things they had learned and received and heard and seen in him. Through New Testament writings, we see Paul's participation in the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. within the local assembly. So, following Paul's example, we see what he did here in this case, and thus we see that we can have faith in what Paul did here. We know that this participation is commanded. Somebody brought out earlier the idea of commanded. In 1 Corinthians 11, Paul wrote to them two times. He says, do this with regard to the bread. And with regard to the fruit of the vine, he said, do this. So we see that it was commanded. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 42, we see that the breaking of the bread was an activity the first Corinthians engaged in a devoted manner. It says they continued steadfastly in the teaching of the apostles and in the fellowship and in the breaking of bread and in prayers. So this idea of devoted and being steadfast in it. So Paul's participation here in Acts 20 and Luke's description of it indicates full approval of this activity as described here in Troas. excuse me. So, with Paul's approval providing an approved example of the day of the week to break bread, the first day of the week, no other passage indicates a day of the week. This is the only passage that we have. So we know, and we can have faith that participation on this day is approved by God. Now, speaking of the first day of the week, I'd like for us to talk about the week. At the beginning, I'd ask some questions. Was this something just for this week? Was it something that just why Paul was there? Was it something that perhaps they did it on this day in Corinth, perhaps not on this day somewhere else? So, you know, was it kind of a custom among those in Corinth? I'd like for us to look at this concept of the week. What can we say about a week? What can we say about it? We know it's 7 days, but what can we say? Okay, all right. A week is a unit or frame of reference. Every week has 7 days, and when a week ends, another one begins. We understand that as a reference of time. Some things aren't good references of time. I remember seeing Halley's Comet back in the 80s, and I don't remember which it was. Either the previous appearance before that or the next one was going to be like 75 years. But then, after down the line, it was going to be like 1,000 years. So that wouldn't make a good reference of time, you see. Is it 75 years between two appearances and 1,000 between the next? That's not a good reference, you see. You know, a reference needs to be something that, you know, one can refer to in a way that everybody understands it. Another thing about the week, every week has a first day. It repeats itself. A first day and a last day. And then a first day, and it works to a last day. Every week has a first day. Just think. Let's look at the wording here. On the first day of the week. It seems so simple. It is so simple, we just go right past it. We don't really stop and think about what's being said here. What if it had said the first day? What if it just said on the first day when we were gathered together to break bread? Well, you're left hanging. The first day of what? You see? It's incomplete. We need something to finish the thought, okay? If it had been talking about, you know, the Passover, then we'd know it was the first day of the Passover. But the Passover is not the context. You know, Pentecost is not the context, you see. So it's the first day of what? Well, it's the first day of the week, you see. He tells us what it's the first day of. What if it said the first day of a week? What if it said a week instead of this week? Well, what does that do to it? Well, see, that removes the emphasis, okay, from the idea of something regular, but just any week. Has nothing to do with anything continuing or anything like that. But it just kind of picks out a week. picks out a week from all the rest of the weeks. And it says, here is a week that on the first day. And that's not the emphasis of this construction. It removes it from this idea of steadfastness and devotedness that we see in Acts 2:42 that we just referenced a minute ago. What if it said on the first day of that week? That week. Well, certainly that would make that week stand out. We would know particularly that it's talking about that week, but it wouldn't be concerned with any other week. It would only be that week that's being talked about. And again, that removes away from the idea of regularity and steadfastness and devotedness. Well, what if it made it really simple? What if it said the first day of every week? Now, when you look at 1 Corinthians 16:2, the other passage that says the first day of the week, well, looking at the King James Version, I believe it says the first day of the week, the same way that it's read here. When you look at later versions, New American Standard and English Standard, it says every week. Well, wouldn't it have been great if it had said for us here the first day of every week? Wouldn't that have just answered the question for so many people? But the problem is it wouldn't have been true, because Paul wasn't there every week. Paul was there that one time. So it would have been incorrect for it to said on the first day of every week when we were gathered together. Paul wasn't there every week. So it wouldn't have been correct to have said that. So it doesn't say that. Well, what if it said the first day of the month? Well, again, it would remove all attention from a weekly observance. And it would certainly remove attention from a day. And I guess it would get back to what calendar you're working in. Because in our calendar, the first day of the month might be any day of the week. It could be any time. So it certainly would remove emphasis from the week altogether. Yes?
The Old Testament example of how God instructed His people in certain days, like Pentecost, on one day of the year, He specified, maybe. It wasn't just ambiguous. And I think this is important to show us that, hey, in the New Testament, it's the same way. God is still the same God. He hadn't changed. He's specific about it.
Okay. Okay. You're right, and you reference the Old Testament, because in Exodus chapter 20, as we're familiar with the Ten Commandments, he talked about, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. The Jews understood that. It was every Sabbath. There was no question in the Jews' mind, yet we've got very similar wording. On the first day of the week, remember the Sabbath. So God established significance of the seven-day period in the creation account, the period of time that we refer to as a week. And this is the reference point with which He established this. Every week has a first day. And I necessarily conclude that the disciples did, and we are to partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week, with every week having a first day. I just don't see how any kind of other conclusion we could come to. Now, so here we've got, in my thinking, a necessary conclusion that's based upon an approved example. An example as such, it would not be limited to Troas, but to all the churches. And this is the only day in which the church, any church, can participate in faith and know that God is pleased. It's the only day that we can do that. Now, but I would suggest something else when we look at examples, that we have to be careful. Because we have an approved example here with reference to the day of the week, doesn't mean that just everything we see an example of, that example that we have to, treat with this same regard. For example, we see here in this same verse, a passage in verse 8, it says they were meeting in an upper room. So we have an example of an upper room. And this is what someone might say to you if they were trying to discredit the use of examples. So, is the upper room binding? Now, to make that thought a little bit more complete, when you look back to Mark's account, as he told disciples to go get a place for them to observe the supper that last time, he told them to go get a upper room. So you have the beginning of the Lord's Supper taking place in an upper room. You have the reference to it here in an upper room. So is the upper room binding? It's an example. It's an approved example. There's an apostle participating in it. So is this an approved apostolic example, to use the expression that we hear, for the upper room? Well, I would suggest to you, if you look back at Mark's account, he told them to get a large upper room. If you look at this upper room here in verse 8, it says it had many lights. So do we need to make sure we get a large upper room that has many lights? And then as we think about things like this and we consider, how many people obeyed the gospel in Acts chapter 2? About 3,000. And we see in subsequent chapters, you know, the number of men came to be about 5,000. Would you describe the upper room that they were in? Actually, where they were was not an upper room, because it tells us in Acts 2 that they were meeting in the temple. So we see then that this concept of an upper room is not a binding concept, you see. So we can answer, you know, such questions. And we can look at examples and say, is that example one that's intended to be binding upon us and to be followed? Certainly, if one would choose to bind that, would find that that's an impossible thing to follow. But we have to be careful when we use the idea of impossible. We have to be careful. It's valid, but we have to use care. Because what does the denominationalist say regarding baptism for someone who's in the middle of the desert? It's impossible for them to be baptized. Therefore, baptism is not required. So when we use the concept of impossible, I caution you to be careful. Okay? In the Philippines, I met with a preacher. And it's one that we were supporting. And our discussion was on some men who were elderly that they weren't baptized, but they were still participating in the service, like, you know, partaking of the Lord's Supper and passing out the emblems and so forth. They were taking part in the service, but they weren't baptized. And so that's what our discussion was on. But here's the reason they weren't baptized. It was almost impossible. Because in the wintertime, the waters were very cold. They didn't have a baptistry. They used a creek. So it was very cold. They were up in the mountains. These men were older, in their 70s, and their bodies couldn't take the cold water. So they were going to wait to springtime in order to baptize. But in the meantime, they were using them in the service. So we talked about how it is possible, you know, and how, you know, if somebody really wanted to be baptized, they could. And get around the concerns they had for the water. But so again, this idea of impossible, you know, can be dangerous, even though there's times when it can be valid. Now, the assumption that we've made so far is that we're talking about the Lord's Supper. Because what does the verse say? On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread. Has anybody in here considered that this might have been a common meal in our discussion? Hadn't entered my mind that it's a common meal, but that is an underlying assumption, because notice what you got in verse 11. And when Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten, he conversed with them a long time until daybreak. So here we've got a very similar expression in verse 11. Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten. So you've got the idea of breaking bread in verse 7 and the breaking bread in verse in verse 11. So what is the relationship, if any, between verse 7 and verse 11? Is what's stated in verse 7 actually accomplished in verse 11? Are they the same thing? Or are these two different things? Is one of these a common meal? Is one of these the Lord's Supper? Or is both of these a common meal? What is it that's being talked about here? Now, I want us to notice something, and I don't use this to explain this passage, but what I want to use it for is to show that this is not the only case where these terms are used multiple times in the same context. Look in Acts 2 and verse 42. And Luke writes here, talking about these new converts, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. So we have here the devotion of these early Christians to this breaking of bread. This is mentioned in context with the teaching of the apostles, the fellowship, the joint sharing is the idea there, and prayer. Here, these people have entered into a new relationship. Now, as we go into verse 46, day by day. Now, notice here, we see a day-by-day emphasis. Every day. Attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes. Now, notice we've got, on a daily basis, we've got two things as opposed one to another. What were they doing day by day? Well, they were attending the temple and they were breaking bread. But what does it show that's distinguishing among them? They were attending the temple. Obviously, that would be in the temple. That would be together, as it says, attending the temple together. But breaking the bread was where? House to house, you see. So what does that tell us? This is not the idea back up in verse 42. Verse 42 is talking about something else. This was a part. Verse 42 springs out of this new relationship they have with Christ. This relationship that causes them to continue in the apostles' doctrine and this sharing together within this relationship, the breaking of bread and prayers and so forth. It comes that relationship. Now, in verse 46, attending the temple together also comes out of that relationship. But what about eating? Does eating come out of a new relationship with Christ? No. That's something they've always done. And that's something, as long as they're here on this earth, they're going to continue to do. So that's our stopping point, and that's where, Lord willing, we'll pick up Wednesday night.